the breath, it is an expression of my interest now at the beginning of the year to talk about some of the basic topics of meditation, and that's what I'd like to do this morning. And what I'd like to talk about is what's called the five faculties. It's an English translation of the Pali word, the pancha indriya. Indriya refers to god or goddess of ancient India, who was considered to be the kind of controller of the world. So the five indriya are the five controlling powers of our inner spiritual life. And these are, classically, usually in English, are translated as faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Though there could be other translations. And as a kind of a introduction to talking about them, I thought of telling you the analogy I've been saying in a number of different places lately. I think some of you haven't heard it. And the analogy is that of two people going out across a lake, a sea, in a rowboat on two different weather days. And one person heads out for the other shore in the rowboat on a day when it's sunny and the water is placid and still and quiet, and there's a gentle breeze blowing from behind, and the currents also are kind of pushing the rowboat along quite nicely. And every time the person dips his or her oars into the water, the boat just sails along, and before you know it, the person has arrived to the other shore. The second person does exactly the same trip across the same body of water, but this time it's stormy weather, and there's gale force winds blowing against the direction that you want to row the boat. The waves are blowing, washing up against the boat. The currents even are blowing against the boat, and so every time the person dips their oars into the water, it's a great struggle to get the boat to move, and maybe the boat moves a couple of inches. And then when the oars are lifted out of the water for the next stroke, the boat is actually pushed back, you know, almost as far as the gain from the last stroke. But slowly, bit by bit, the person makes it across to the other shore and reaches the destination. And now it's possible that the first person congratulates him or herself for the great accomplishment. What a great rower the person is, and I must be a real expert. I really get there real fast, it's possible the second one considers that, oh, what a lousy rower I am. I'm struggling. If someone was a better rower, they'd know better how to row and how to negotiate these big waves, and you know, it's been really hard for me. And however, the difference between the two rowers, besides what they might conclude about themselves, which is optional, is the second person has gotten stronger. And that's a big difference, because the second one has built up strength in struggling against, you know, in the storm, and is better prepared for future challenges. Whereas the first one perhaps is actually less prepared for future challenges, not only because maybe they haven't built up any strength, but because of that self-congratulatory flavor, which might get in the way when there's a challenge in the future. Meditation is a little bit like this, that many Western meditators, and many meditators maybe everywhere, focus a lot on the goal of meditation, and in doing that they often focus on particular experiences that they think meditation is about. Many Western meditators, I've noticed, are kind of experience junkies. They're looking for the great experience. They'll experience the great calm, the great the great peace. It's quite varied what people are interested in. And an experience of the non-dual, unity with the cosmos, you know, some experience which, you know, and they have some idea that some experience is going to be the key or the solution. If they only have that experience, then they'll live happily ever after. And so they'll measure their success of their meditation by did I have that experience? Did I have some experience which I value? And then occasionally people do have wonderful experiences, and then they spend the next year or 10 years trying to have it back again. But another way of looking at a Buddhist spiritual life is, rather than it being primarily being about experience, it's about developing qualities within us, developing virtue, developing personal character, developing inner qualities of strength, strengthening them so that they become a foundation for spiritual growth and maturity. And this is quite important, because it's possible to have wonderfully transcendent experiences in meditation or outside, and unless there's a really firm, big foundation for those experiences can make a person quite wobbly, quite uncertain about how to live in the world, negotiate the world. And so it's important to have a very big, a very strong base for a person's spiritual life, in that many people look for the peak, the top of the mountain, for example. Before the base is set, they're just seeking for that high experience without taking care of the foundation makes, again, the spiritual life quite wobbly. And for day-to-day spirituality in the Buddhist tradition, it's almost better to think about it as being developing these inner strengths as opposed to hanging on or seeking a particular experience that we're having. And so there are many qualities that can be developed. Certainly, the five faculties is one of them, the five potentials that we have, the five strengths that exist within us, potentially. And there are a lot of others. Discipline, compassion, discernment, resolve, determination, kindness. All these are qualities inside of us that can be developed. But also the five faculties. These five faculties are considered very important for people who do meditation. Other qualities are very important in a wider spiritual life, and I could talk a little bit about the wider foundation, but as you kind of go one tier up, one level up from the basic foundation, the five faculties are incredibly important. And you find Vipassana teachers, especially classically in Thailand, when they listen to a meditation student's description of their meditation, how they're doing, and the teacher's seeing how they can help and give advice, one of the things they're listening to is, how are the five faculties balanced? How are they being developed? And the teacher will listen, oh, that person maybe needs more of one of these, one of the five, or more of this other the five, and we'll kind of encourage and kind of encourage the development of the student's meditation by developing the one that might be lagging behind. And the understanding is the five faculties need to be balanced together. So the five faculties, again, classically in English are translated as faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And just to kind of give you a sense of an alternative, maybe we could also call them trust, engagement, honesty, stability, and insight or understanding. Those kind of synonyms of each other. Some teachers emphasize that these can be developed sequentially, that as a person's inspired by their faith, that of course they're going to engage themselves, put effort into practice. As people put effort into practice, they're going to become more aware, more present, more mindful. As they become more aware and present, then with time will come greater stability, greater concentration. And as this greater concentration coupled together with our presence, our mindfulness, there will come greater insight and wisdom. Other teachers emphasize the importance of balancing them, and they'll see that the five are balanced with mindfulness in the middle, so that faith and wisdom balance each other. They're kind of the outer wing. And then inside of those is energy and concentration, and they need to be balanced. And mindfulness, it said, doesn't need to be balanced, because you can never have enough mindfulness, and you never have too much of it. But you can have too much of the others. You can have too much faith, you have too much wisdom, You can have too much energy, you can have too much concentration. If it's, and too much means it's not balanced with the other factor. If you develop one to a great pitch, you don't necessarily have to let go of it as much as you need to strengthen the other so it provides the balance for it. So you can probably, some of you imagine maybe better than I can explain here, the imbalances that can occur when faith and wisdom don't exist in balance. If there's too much faith, it can be blind faith, and the person can be greatly inspired, but then latch on to particular beliefs, particular practices, particular teachers, particular groups or whatever, blindly, and without any real understanding of what's going on inside of them, what the attachments and the fears are that are operating, without any wisdom. If there's a lot of understanding, for example, but not enough faith, not enough wisdom, then there's a lot of wisdom without enough faith, then it can be kind of dry. It can be kind of a dry understanding, an understanding disconnected with our emotional life. If our spiritual life is going to be a lived life, it has to kind of include all our aspects of our life, not only our intellectual aspects, which is more kind of the wisdom side, but also our emotional sides, which tend to be more belong to the realm of faith. So, and remember, I've told this story before, I believe, of when I was first practicing Buddhism, Buddhist practice, I did have a certain amount of wisdom, but it left me as being a little bit aloof with some of the people who were key around me. I kind of began having some appreciation, some understanding of some of the interpersonal games that people played, or interpersonal needs that people acted on. And I had a girlfriend who had a great need for getting, she actually used the word stokes, I think was the word, to be stoked, to kind of get praise and kind of get appreciated a lot. And I was beginning to feel it was kind of like a neurotic need to always get this kind of constant affirmation. And there was kind of represented a kind of insecurity there. And I could see her insecurity and could see that she had this need and she was kind of expecting to get, you know, these affirmations. And I wasn't interested in playing those games anymore because I had all this wisdom now from my practice. And so that particular relationship didn't last very long, you can imagine. But then I realized some years later that, in fact, I had some insight, had some understanding of what was going on with her and with myself, and there was some wisdom operating, and I didn't want to play those games anymore. But what was lacking in me was compassion. I didn't have any understanding of the suffering there, and I wasn't able to meet her at kind of the more deeper emotional level that was going on both in her and in me. And I regretted, my aloofness, my coldness. So wisdom, in a sense, needs to be balanced with faith and maybe some other things also. Energy needs to be balanced with concentration with energy. It's said that if there's a lot of engagement, a lot of in practice, a lot of efforting, then a person could easily get agitated. If there's too much concentration and not enough energy, then the person can get soporific, can get tired, dull. The mind can get dull and sleepy and tired. The two need to be balanced. There has to be energy to balance the stability and the calm of the mind, concentration and calm being considered synonymous, and there needs to be calm or concentration to balance the energy, because then energy becomes agitating. So I'm telling you all this so that you can get some sense of how to maybe moderate your own meditation practice. This is, you can look at your own practice and see, is there how well are these present, and do I need more of one or the other? And particularly important for people who do a lot of meditation is the balance between energy and concentration. As you're sitting and you find yourself maybe very inspired and putting in a lot of good effort in practice, are you actually putting in too much? Are you getting agitated? Is your mind too scattered, too energized? And maybe you need to focus more on concentration, which means, in a sense, simplifying the practice and maybe just hanging on with the breath, just staying with the breath very matter-of-factly, kind of hanging in there, hanging on to it perhaps even or some other object of concentration, so the mind can get calm and stabilized and steady. Or if you might notice that you're getting really sleepy, you might find yourself, you are pretty concentrated and pretty calm in your meditation, but calm and concentration meditation is a setup for getting sleepy and or getting dull. And so the mind kind of begins to sink. The sinking mind sets in, the person might actually fall asleep. And so you have to be very attentive to when your calm in meditation begins shifting over to a dullness, to a kind of cloudiness of the mind. And it's very seductive, because a person can feel like, oh, I'm really present, I'm calm, things are going really well in my meditation. And there's kind of self-congratulatory kind of approach to it. But then, because of the pleasantness of it, they don't really notice that actually the mind is getting duller and duller. And the mind actually, in a dull mind, actually might start fantasizing, start thinking a lot. And you might not even notice you're thinking a lot, because you're kind of been so dulled by the calm. So a meditator needs to be alert to this movement of dullness, to the movement of kind of lethargy or tiredness or sleepiness that might set in if you get calm. And you need to bring in more energy into the system, more engagement, more application of your mindfulness. Apply yourself more diligently to both the posture, by sitting up straighter perhaps. It's a great way of getting more energy, having a better, stronger posture. Or applying your mind more diligently, brightening the mind, bringing more alertness to the mind, bringing in more factor of investigation to what your experience is. You know, what's actually going on here? One of the qualities we want to develop is investigation. If we're kind of focusing on experience, and one of the classic ones for meditators is calm, let me get calm, let me get calm, then we might be overlooking this very important quality of investigation. Not only is investigation important because we learn to see more clearly what's going on, but we're also developing that muscle of investigation itself, which is a very important muscle to develop. So concentration and energy need to be balanced. So faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and insight. Faith is a word which is not very popular among a number of Western Buddhists, because they hear that word and they think they're expected to adhere blindly to some creed, that faith means some kind of belief system you have to kind of buy into. And the faith, as part of the five faculties, doesn't refer to a kind of creed or a kind of belief system. It rather is almost better translated perhaps as conviction or as trust, as confidence, as inspiration. And a lot of it has to do with having confidence in oneself, having some confidence that we can make a difference in our own meditation practice, so in our own spiritual practice, that we have that the choices we make, the choices we can make, are very consequential in our spiritual life. If you don't have some confidence in that, then you're not going to fall back on your ability to make choices and find that you can actually make a difference. One of the central items of faith in Buddhism, which some people do take a little bit as a kind of faith in a belief system, but it doesn't have to be this, is faith that your intended actions have consequences, that the intended choices you make have some consequences in your life, either in the right now or sometime in the future. That if you make choices which are disrespectful of others, or choices which transgress against the well-being of others, that those choices that you make will come back to you, will have consequences not only to the people out there who you affect, but affect, for example, the habit formations of the mind, the tendencies of the mind to act that way more in the future, or to powers of regret in the future. If you break the five precepts, for example, it tends to make a person insensitive. It makes that person an insensitive person. Because to break the precepts, to lie or steal, kill or harm people, can only really be done if a person is insensitive. And it increases the forces of insensitivity to keep doing those kinds of things. And in that, mindfulness practice is a practice of becoming sensitive, and goes in cross purposes to the cultivation of sensitivity. If we rather focus on how to be more sensitive to the people around us and to ourselves, that choice has long-term consequences. It predisposes us to be more sensitive in the future. So one of the faith and karma, which is as often simply described in Buddhism, refers to faith that our intended actions have consequences, which again means that our choices can make a difference in our lives. And this, I think, very, very important for Buddhist practitioners to see that there's where the responsibility lies for our well-being, our suffering. And one of the great challenges that in Buddhist practice, and for some people quite disturbing teaching, is the idea that our suffering, in its core, in its essence, really has its source in choices we make in ourselves. And this is disturbing because many people assume that their suffering comes from the people around, the world around them, the situation around them. And in some sense it does, but in the core spiritual sense it comes from ourselves. The analogy that John Travis used at the last retreat was you kind of develop his analogy. If you want to grasp a burning fire, so you take your hand and you put your hand into the fire to grasp it, you can't really grasp the flames however, in trying to grasp it and put your hands in the flame, you burn yourself. And that's classically kind of an analogy of how grasping burns the grasper. However, if you take it a little bit further, if you put your hand into the flame to grasp it, it's very easy for people in kind of many conventional situations to blame the fire. The fire is burning. Fire is what's burning my hand. And of course, I mean, it's fair to say that. It's accurate to say that. The cause of the burn is the fire. But from a spiritual point of view, from the point of view of our inner life, the cause of that of the burning of ourselves is not the fire. It's the fact that we reached out to grasp it. From a spiritual point of view, you have to understand the fire's role in it, of course. But from a spiritual point of view, we have to really well understand that our reaching out to grasp that is a source of the pain that arises there. It's like some years ago I was getting off the freeway near here and on Page Mill, and you could use a stop sign for me and the stop sign for the people coming up Page Mill. And I stopped and there's a person coming from the right, and I started to go because they had a stop sign they had to stop for, but the person didn't see the stop sign. I went right through and just barely missed me by maybe a centimeter or something, and I reflected after, well, if that was close, and if that person wasn't paying attention, was a careless driver, if that person had hit me, I'm sure that the laws of our state would have assumed that that person is responsible for the accident, and in being responsible for the accident, they would have to pay for the accident, I suppose, because they went through a stop sign. But from a spiritual point of view, it's much more interesting and more important to turn the mirror back on myself and say, how was I behaving? How was I acting prior to that accident? Because if I had been in a hurry, impatient, I could have set myself up so that I might not have noticed that the person was missing that stop sign. And in a sense, my impatience, my hurry, my grasping for getting someplace was for me, from a spiritual point of view, the source of that problem. Does that make some sense? So in conventional terms, we might want to look externally for the causes of our suffering, but spirituality doesn't belong so much to the conventional world, and so we have to be able to learn how to look back in ourselves and see, what are we doing? What's going on within me? Not to deny what's going on outside, but to really see where we can make a difference. And so part of this thing about faith is to have faith that it really makes a difference to look into ourselves, and that we can make a difference in our lives by looking in and seeing where the choices reside. Of course, faith also can mean things like, as an extension of this, confidence in oneself. It could also be a form of inspiration. And inspiration is a very important part of spiritual life. And, for example, to be inspired that it's possible to become free, it's possible to have some attainment. It's possible to develop oneself. And inspiration can come from many places. It can come from knowing people who've practiced a lot and seen their example and be inspired by it, inspired by the example of the Buddha. It can be inspired by the community of people you practice with. It can be inspired by books that you read. There's many sources of inspiration, and inspiration is a very important quality in spiritual life. Inspiration is kind of can be filled with joy and delight, sometimes rapture. It's kind of infusing our emotional body, emotional self, into the practice, which is very important. I think one of the flavors of American Vipassana movement, it has a kind of a Protestant flavor, a kind of a white Protestant flavor, you know, which if you go to hear Ellen's gospel singing, you hear maybe the difference between us Protestants. We sit quietly, we don't do much, and no rituals. And so the emotional part, sometimes it doesn't seem to be so present. But emotional part of practice is a very important part of practice. And if you go to other communities where practice Buddhism, for example in Asia or Asian communities, you find actually a much stronger level of emotional involvement in the practice. And sometimes, of course, that leads to blind faith, but doesn't have to. It's part of the beauty, I think, of a fully developed life. So the faith is important. And so you can look at that. Is faith an important part of you? Do you have an aversion to the very idea of faith? And if that's the case, can you look at that and investigate that and maybe find out what's going on for you? Do you have a lot of faith? And if you have a lot of faith, maybe do you have too much faith? And, is your faith kind of blind? The second faculty is the faculty of energy, engagement, effort. I like the word engagement because spiritual life, you have to engage yourself in life, in the spiritual life, in spiritual practice. It's not something, sometimes it's kind of magical thinking among meditators, which takes the form of, if I just go through the motion of being a meditator, if I just sit and meditate, sit in meditation posture, if I go on retreats and endless retreats, and put in my time, like my duty or something, then eventually something will happen to me. It just, it'll be my right, to something to happen. And I've known people who've done this, who've gone for years and years on meditation retreats, kind of expecting by some magic event something was going to happen to them, given to them. But unless there's some kind of serious engagement, involvement, applying ourselves, then it's like just reading going to a restaurant and reading the menu and never eating. If you endlessly read books about spirituality and get inspired, but don't engage yourself in the practice itself, then it's not going to do you much good. So there has to be some involvement, some applying oneself, and some people have a reluctance to that. Some people feel my life is too busy as it is, I don't want to add anything to it. Some people feel that it's an imposition. They don't want to impose anything, their life is fine, and they don't want anything imposed in their life, even though they want to be spiritual, but they have to do something, it should just be given to them. But it requires doing something, and when you engage yourself in any kind of spiritual practice, it requires making some kind of choices, sometimes some sacrifices between letting go of other things that might actually be quite useful things to do, so you have the time and the ability to engage yourself in your spiritual practice. It could also be engagement in the course of your daily life. It doesn't mean you have to let go of certain things, but you decide to do the things that you do with greater presence, greater mindfulness. That as something as simple as you drive, that you're going to do that mindfully, as opposed to succumb to the forces of impatience. So, engagement, to be engaged. So the third one is mindfulness. And as I said, you can never have too much mindfulness. And mindfulness is the very simple capacity of the mind, of the heart, to know what's happening while it's happening. And it's a function of memory to know what's happening after it's happened, next day or something. But mindfulness is to know what's happening as it's happening. And the engagement of engaging yourself in mindfulness practice is to engage ourselves in the practice of knowing what's happening while it's happening. If something happens in your meditation practice, and you know, 5 minutes later you notice, oh, that was interesting what happened 5 minutes ago, and you start thinking and remembering that, then you're caught in the past, and you're no longer doing mindfulness, you're doing memory practice. If you are sitting and you find that you are trying to stay with your breath, and your mind wanders away, and you notice the mind has wandered away, and then you start criticizing yourself for going mind wandering away, then you're doing memory practice again. Because it's out of the memory of what happened that you begin judging yourself. What we do in mindfulness practice is we notice the mind wanders away, and we keep focusing on what's happening right now. Oh, the mind is wandering away, let's come back to the breath. There's no need to rehearse or review the past or to judge it. Just stay in the moment, what's going on right now. And part of the beauty of mindfulness practice is that our awareness itself, awareness in and of itself, never judges, never criticizes, never has any aversion, never is impatient. Awareness itself is kind of like a mirror which just reflects matter-of-factly what is there. As we engage ourselves in mindfulness practice, this mirror-like quality of the mind, this luminous quality of the mind, gets stronger and stronger, and it becomes a very important alternative for people to the usual preoccupations we have. Most of us have some identity, some way we identify, some aspect of ourselves that we identify as who I am. And we measure ourselves and our life by our identity. And some of these identities are accurate enough, and some of them are quite imaginary. But whether they're real or not, if we're preoccupied with the identity, if we take this to be all of who we are, then we're caught up in that which is changeable and that which is threatenable. But as the mindfulness gets stronger and the luminosity of the mind, the stability of this inner mirror gets stronger, we realize that some part of us doesn't judge, doesn't criticize, doesn't hang on to anything, doesn't require an identity, is independent and free of all those things. And part of the function of mindfulness is to develop that quality of ourselves so we can recognize as part of us which is actually always independent of the world we live in. And that gives us tremendous power to realize that there's part of us which is independent. If we always feel like we're independent from the world, then, you know, our well-being kind of goes up and down depending on how that dependent relationship goes. The fourth faculty is concentration, stability of mind, steady focus. For mindfulness practitioners, one of the things this means, it means a steady continuity of the mindfulness practice. A constant stream of staying in the present moment and staying with what's going on. What's happening now, what's happening now, what's happening now. To have a dedication to maintaining the stream of noticing. Because if you start noticing, what you'll notice is how quickly you interrupt the stream of noticing. You're paying attention to something, and you have a thought or a memory, and you get involved in it. You have a pain, and the mind locks on that pain. Or someone you know, does something in the room that seems irritating to you, and suddenly you're locked on resenting all the people in the world who ever, you know, scratch their noses in meditation retreats or whatever. And so the mind kind of stops for all kinds of things. And concentration for mindfulness students is a mind that doesn't stop. We don't get stopped by thoughts or concerns. The classic analogy is you're sitting mindfully and thought trains are passing through. And then a particularly interesting wagon train goes by, and so you jump on the train and off you go. And then you stopped for that wagon, got on. In mindfulness practice, you want to stay in the present moment, just noticing what's going on and not letting yourself stop for anything. Which means, it's the day for it. Keep noticing what's happening now, what's happening now, what's happening now. Noticing this breath, now I'm thinking, now I'm hearing, Now I'm thinking about what I'm hearing, I'm going off on that train, or noticing going off on that train, that's what's happening now, coming back to the breath. And what it means, this is where faith becomes very important, because you have to have, I think it's really important to have some faith that it's worthwhile not to let the mind stop for some preoccupation and concern. Not to stop to consider something or think about it or get involved in something in the mind, but rather maintain the steady stream of noticing, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. And letting that's kind of like, it's like a stream, it's like a running stream through your life that keeps flowing. And you want to keep that that stream flowing constantly, stream of noticing, stream of awareness. Maybe rather than the mind being a mirror, maybe it's more like a stream that reflects everything. And you want to maintain that, you want to keep that stream flowing smoothly and continuously as you can. So the bumper sticker for Vipassana students is, I stop for nothing. And I did bring a quote today. I don't know if you can have a Vipassana talk without a quote. Maybe it's just another way of stopping, but it's very nice. There's a wonderful Cambodian teacher named Mahagusananda, one of the few really great monks to survive the genocide of Cambodia. And he writes this: the Buddha called the practice of mindfulness the only way, always in the present, at this very moment, from moment to moment, in all activity, in this very step. This is why we say step by step. Each step is a meditation. When the children in Providence see me off at the station, as I walk up to the train, they shout, slowly, slowly, step by step. Each step is a prayer. And all the passengers look and smile. This saying has become famous. The children do not know English well, but they know the sentence by heart. They are the new Cambodia, and already they know the way to peace. Already they know the way to peace. In Cambodia, we say, a journey of 10,000 miles begins with a single step. Slowly, slowly, step by step, each step is a meditation, each step is a prayer. So to be engaged in practice, engaged in being mindful, and doing it step by step, not letting anything trip you up, not needing to measure or judge what's going on, not need to consider what happened yesterday, the day before, not needing to plan about the future, not needing to get up involved in any fantasy, but just step by step, step by step. Now this is where the rowboat analogy is very important, because many of us expect the spiritual life to be, not many of us, but some people expect spiritual life to be all about joy and ease and calm and delight and but I think that's very superficial. Buddhist spiritual life is about engaging ourselves with all our life as it is. And life is partly joy and delight, but also partly crisis and suffering and times of great struggle. And if you come to your meditation practice at times of crisis, at times of difficulty, it's very hard to stay with the breath. It's very hard to stay present. And if you then measure yourself negatively and say, well, gee, you know, I'm doing this really poorly, I can't do it, I'm a failure, then certainly you stop, the mind has stopped when you've done that, but maybe more importantly is that you're kind of undermining your very efforts to practice, and you're making kind of a necessary conclusion. It might be that you're quite a good meditator, but you're just now in big storms. And in big storms, it's very hard to make any progress. However, in the fact that you're engaging with the practice in a stormy time, you're developing those muscles. And that's what's important, is developing those muscles. Not that you have some beautiful, calm meditation where you kind of don't develop any of those muscles anymore. And the beauty about this kind of strengthening of muscles is that you might have something you want to try to accomplish. And even if you don't accomplish it, but because you tried, you still developed some of that strength. And in that we often focus on the goal, we lose track of this very important development of strength that's going on. So in meditation practice, if you find a time when it's really hard to stay present with your breath or present at all, don't get discouraged. this might actually be a really important time for developing your strength. It means you give it the best effort you have, and your best effort might not be as good as some other times, but you give it the best effort you have, and you might not even succeed. But because you keep trying, giving your best effort, you're developing that strength, which will serve you really well in the future. So don't just give up because it's difficult. Don't give up because you can't succeed. Succeeding is not as important as engaging yourself, and in the engagement, developing some of these things. And then the last faculty is the faculty of wisdom, or insight. And this is when the mindfulness and the mirror-like quality of the mind is clear enough, we begin seeing much more clearly what makes us work, what goes on inside of us. We begin seeing very clearly how we latch on and get attached. We see clearly the possibility of letting the mind become free and not contracted around that, grasping that fire. We begin seeing something about the nature of what our experience is of life. We can see, for example, the impermanence of life. One of the primary sources of insight in Buddhism is to see impermanence. And the people who deny impermanence tend to suffer much more than those people who see it. So as the practice deepens, we tend to see much more. And part of the function of mindfulness is to see what's actually going on. So the combination of being able to see more clearly what's going on and developing these other strengths are two very important foundations of the mindfulness practice. And then the last thing I'll say is that part of the danger in talking about the five faculties like this is that a person can get too obsessed with adjusting their practice. Just a little bit more energy here, a little more concentration here. And there's dangers in everything, and even learning how to row a boat has some dangers. And but you have to go out and try until you learn how to do it. If you want to ride a bicycle, you might fall a few times, but then eventually you'll learn and it becomes easy. And so same with the five faculties. To learn what these are, get a sense of them and some familiarity with them, and then to be able to track a little bit these strengths, these abilities, these faculties within you, and see how they are. And see, do you need to kind of strengthen one of them or another one of them? And are there realistic ways that you can do that? Whether you do that or not, if you practice mindfulness, moment by moment, trying not to stop for anything, just... Should I stop? Then the five faculties will develop on their own. And the five faculties, when they get well developed, then they transform themselves into another Buddhist list. And that other Buddhist list is called the five powers, Panchabala. And the five powers is exactly the same list. So I think there's a couple of minutes if there's anything anyone wants to ask or... Please. How can one increase faith? I think probably begin by looking at what that word means for you. And also looking around and seeing what it might mean for some other people. Because sometimes we learn by other people's understandings. Maybe it can be more than what I thought it is, or maybe it can be different or something. And so that's one place to begin. Another is to begin studying in yourself and in others this principle I talked about earlier, the principle that your intended actions have consequence. And that's one of the primary things we Buddhists are supposed to have faith in, and that's the case. So if you begin investigating that's the case and how it might be the case, maybe getting someone to help you kind of look at that, you might over time start seeing, oh yeah, my intended actions have consequences, my intended choices have consequences. Partly faith can arise out of a reflective practice. You can reflect a little bit at the deepest sources of well-being, the deepest sources of connectedness to the world, deepest kind of spiritual sensitivities that you've ever touched on in your life. It could be sometimes as a child, it could be sometimes you know, something happened in adulthood, but some can remember back. It's okay. Even the mindfulness practice is not about remembering. There are times when it's quite fine to remember, and sometimes you can get a lot of faith by remembering something important that happened to you earlier. That, you know, I touched something here, and that was really valuable, and be inspired by that. You can get inspired by wonderful teachings. Faith can come from that. So if you have certain books that you know about, certain writings that really inspire you, really speak to you, you can read that, and it can really sometimes really empower your faith quite dramatically. So those are things that come to mind. I think everyone here probably could answer the question a little bit differently. So you should ask around. Please.
and then I'm aware of how quietly we're all sitting, you know, and you were sitting very quietly. And I don't always know about this thing in me that I can see the value for me, and experience the value when I sit and create a container for that incredible fullness.
Right.
Quietly. And yet
the Protestant flavor, the Protestant limitations. it's a very important topic, and as I maybe said in the past, sometimes, the way that our meditation practice come to the West, it came as a truncated or very reduced, simplified spiritual tradition. The teachers just brought the Vipassana practice by itself, basically, and left behind much of the wider spiritual context and container for that, within which it exists in Southeast Asia. And some of that, for example, is the ritual aspects of practice. And the ritual aspects of practice are very important from many different points of view. They can strengthen faith, develop faith, to do the rituals and bowing and chanting, and it's one way to develop it. You see how I didn't even mention the first time or so, you know. I should have mentioned it right away, but I didn't, because we have such a bias, you know. That's one way, but also ritual is also a way of expressing what comes up. So as faith, as inspiration, as gratitude, feelings of gratitude come up, it's very important to have some way of expressing that. And so having rituals, for example, after meditation is one way of giving voice, giving expression to this. When I was living in the monasteries, we often did that, chanting and bowing after meditation. And I found it really invaluable, because I would leave my meditation filled with these feelings that wanted to be expressed, and so I had an expression for it right away. You will have a chance, I think, and soon enough, in a questionnaire that's going to go out to the Sangha, to write if you want to have some kind of activities like this in the Sangha. I've been reluctant to do a lot of this, as you all know, in our regular kind of sitting groups, but I've always considered that it'd be valuable to do it some other times. Many years ago, for a while, we did full moon gatherings. We met full moons and chanted during the full moon, which is very traditional. And it might be nice someday, maybe, when we have our own center, especially. And then if we have our own center, then I'm hoping that they're planning to include some elements like this, so that some people who find it valuable can do it. Maybe not part of our regular sitting group time, but maybe some other times where there can be some sitting and some ritual. I've never heard of even in Southeast Asia, of people in the middle of a Dharma talk doing the equivalent of hallelujah. However, at the end of a Dharma talk in Burma, for example, there is the equivalent of it, but it happens at the end. And of course, you can do that with as much passion as you want. And that is, at the end of a Dharma talk, you say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu three times. Should we do that? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Was that enough? Was that enough? Was that strong enough? Cheryl.
You know, I just want to say that what we were talking about, we were kind of attempting to implement within the full moon gathering for the summer moon. And so it's an experiment in progress, and we're hoping we can include everyone who'd like to join us. We'll start with the women. It's that same idea of expressing that deep inner awareness that we need a place to do it. So that's what it's about.
Great. Steve, and then these last two, and then we'll stop.
Yes. I want to agree with you. When I did Zen practice years ago, there was something about the service that sort of brought it together. I mean, the Zen retreats I found much more intense than the Vipassana retreats. You get up much earlier. It's much more strict, and the service sort of like brought it together. And this expression also of bowing. Nice. The other thing, can you translate for people what sadhu means?
Sadhu means excellent. Good, sadhu, great. Great.
I'm just curious to know how you would balance the. I know that there are specific injunctions that are read in the suttas against ritual, specifically against ritual.
Injunctions against it?
Yes.
Yes.
Perhaps I should find them and give them.
No, I think if you're talking about the attachment.
Yeah, there's very clear. It's a very clear. One of the important so-called fetters, forms of attachment that practice is supposed to overcome, is the attachment to rites and rituals. But it doesn't mean that they can't use them. It means you're not supposed to be attached to them. But in the famous list of the 10 fetters, it's not so much attachment to rites and rituals which are being talked about, but it's a misunderstanding that rites and rituals in and of themselves can be a cause for liberation. So even though rituals are a very important part of a spiritual life, it's not going to cause the ultimate liberation that Buddhist practice is about. Well, thank you very kindly for listening, and I'll see you next week.